This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks for listening. And this hour, on this beginning of the week, we're going to take a look at the role of government in regulating public information. It's an issue that spans everything from gun control laws and federal background checks to the prosecution of people who invade data networks to liberate information they believe should be public. In both domains, it turns out, the government role constitutes a matter of life and death. That's what we're going to find out this hour. But first, the case of gun control laws. You buy a gun in a traditional and legal retail establishment, and a background check is required. We all know that. But did you know how many of those would-be gun buyers get turned down and why? Well, in 2010, according to the Department of Justice, around 80,000 Americans were denied guns because they lied or provided inaccurate information about their criminal histories during a background check. Only 44 of those were charged with committing a crime. And our partner, The New York Times, is reporting that the Obama administration is now studying this pattern of dishonesty in these so-called lie-and-try transactions and the apparent lack of prosecutions. It could all be part of the new approach to gun violence Vice President Joe Biden is expected to announce in a series of recommendations for overhauling national gun policy that will be announced this week. But what does this application review process actually look like in action, especially in states with tough gun control laws that may end up being something of a model for a new federal policy? Well, reporter Ann Mastu is with us from our partner WGBH in Boston. Ann, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
So, Ann, how did you approach, getting an idea of what this review process looks like in communities around Massachusetts?
Well, I chose two cities, Lowell and Cambridge. I wanted to interview police in cities that had a fair number of applications each month. Cambridge and Lowell are about the same size, but they're very different cities. Lowell's more diverse, socioeconomically at least, and it's seen a sharp increase in gun permit applications in the last few years. Here's Detective Karen Witz of the Lowell Police, and she oversees the application process.
Some are very adamant about wanting to be able to carry 24/7. However, each city and town is allowed to put restrictions on license to carry. So our chief here, he has set forth a guideline. And if you meet that guideline, he lifts the restriction and allows you to carry unrestricted.
So it seems like there's a lot of discretion from community to community, not a lot of uniformity here.
That's right. There are certain criteria, or they call them disqualifiers. But each police officer in each town, there's one per town, will scrutinize each applicant's driving record, do a national criminal background check, and review mental health records with state hospitals. But the only things that absolutely eliminate someone from being eligible for gun ownership is having, I should say a gun permit, is having been an inpatient at a mental health facility, having a felony, or committing a violent crime. A police officer can still decide, based on other factors, that a person is not, quote, suitable to operate a gun. And there's a really fine balance in Massachusetts between a person's Second Amendment right and the police officer's opinion.
What did you make of Detective Witt's attitude about this whole gun control application process? Was she real hard about it, or was she pretty lax?
She was pretty tough about it. But because the gun control laws are strict in Massachusetts, the applicants are fairly self-selective. Detective Witt said that last year she had about 500 applicants. She only turned down about 12 people.
So she's not a big denier, but that's partly because of the pool of applicants already sort of comes to the table, really not trying to pull one over on the authorities. How does this work in one particular case that you studied?
Well, one example came up when Cambridge Deputy Jack Albert reviewed a young woman's application.
A young white female just moved into the Cambridge area, said that the area that in Cambridge that she was in fear. And she wanted a Class A license so she could carry the firearm for protection.
Now, what happened in this case?
Yeah, this woman didn't have any felonies or mental health history, no other assaults or criminal issues. But Deputy Albert decided not to give her the concealed weapons privilege that she had applied for, instead giving her a license restricted for hunting and target practice only. But she can reapply, not for 6 years. And here's his logic.
Other than the 8-hour firearm safety course, there was no indication she had any experience at all with firearms. It's our position that if it's your first-time applicant and you have no past history with handling firearms, you weren't in the military, you weren't a police officer, then we're probably going to issue you a Class A license for target and hunting. She has a Second Amendment right, but as the issuing agency, we also have a right to review what's good for the people of Cambridge.
So what's the takeaway here, Anne? I mean, would you say that the review process, again, we're talking about carry and conceal permits, not the standard federal background check, so it's a more restrictive process, and it should be. Do you think that this is an appropriate level of uniformity, of government oversight, of exclusion? Did the rate of denials jive with what you expected?
It did. It did expect. I mean, it made me feel safe as a resident of Massachusetts. I think that certain people would feel more strongly about allowing people to have concealed weapons. It's very rare that someone has a concealed weapons permit in Massachusetts, but it's not too difficult to get a gun permit if you want to shoot a gun for target or hunting purposes.
So would you say that if the Massachusetts process becomes a model under the Joe Biden recommendations, that it would be applicable and replicatable in other states around the United States?
I'm not sure that I can speak for other states, but I think that it would change a lot of culture in other states. I mean, Massachusetts generally is a very low gun permit per capita state. I mean, only about 1% of people in Cambridge have a gun. I think that it would be very unusual. Having myself lived in Maine and Alaska, there were a lot more people who had guns in those states than do here in Massachusetts.
It's a cultural question much more than a legal question. Reporter for our partner WGBH, Anne Mostu, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So from on-the-ground practice to some national models for gun reform in America, and joining me now is someone with a lot of information about that, James Fox, professor of criminology, law, and public policy at Northeastern University. Professor Fox, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So is the background check mechanism the basic model for national gun control at this point? And what's the record of effectiveness of regulating specific classes of weapons and ammunition?
Well, let's take them one at a time. In terms of background checks, certainly that's one of the big loopholes that the anti-gun forces have been pointing out in terms of the gun show loophole, and that many gun transactions are made privately, are made at gun shows, without a background check. Now, background checks make a lot of sense, but let's also recognize that they do have the limitations. For example, people would like to say we need to keep guns out of the hands of mentally ill persons. Well, actually, when you think about mass murderers, which is certainly the motivation here, so most mass murderers do not have criminal records, and they have not been institutionalized for psychiatric reasons. So we'd like to think that background checks can solve all of our problems, but really they can't. So they're a good idea, but they won't necessarily resolve the problem of mass murder that's behind all of this.
And what about regulating specific classes of weapons, ammunition, clips, and the like? Mm-hmm.
Sure. The extent to which we can reduce the deadliness, the lethality of weapons would be great in terms of assault weapons, in terms of the high-capacity magazines. A couple problems there, too, is that mass killers are extremely determined to carry out their mission. They will find a way, no matter what impediments we put in their way. There are already millions of these weapons in circulation, and even if they couldn't find an assault weapon or a weapon with a high-capacity magazine, certainly there are other weapons that are at their disposal. In fact, most mass murderers don't use assault weapons. They use semi-automatic pistols and rifles. The assault weapons ban that we had in the 1990s, though a good idea, didn't have a major effect on mass killing. It was a little nibble, if anything, at all. So a lot of the proposals we hear today in terms of curtailing the access to guns are the right thing. But if you're expecting it to as many people say, ensure that Sandy Hook will never happen again, then you'll be bitterly disappointed, because it will happen.
Is Sandy Hook the wrong bar here, in the sense that making guns less available to people who, out of passion or some sort of emotional state, grab one and go kill, is actually a much bigger, in number terms, source of fatalities in gun violence?
Absolutely. The mass shooting we saw in Sandy Hook and we saw in Aurora are well-planned executions. They're not spontaneous. They're not just suddenly someone going berserk and going into a store and buying a gun. So the kind of restrictions we hear about will have a major effect. We'll take a big bite out of crime, but mass murder probably less so, if anything.
James Fox, professor of criminology, law, and public policy at Northeastern University. What do you make of the argument that the NRA makes that if the government increases the number and specificity of background checks in all levels of gun purchases and closes the gun show loophole, if possible, that the government will have a whole lot of information about where the guns are, who has them, and why, and that that in and of itself is a Second Amendment constitutional problem?
Well, I don't think it's a constitutional problem, personally. I trust the most gun owners. 99.9% are extremely trustworthy. But there are some who are not. And I think there's a certain level of paranoia that runs deep among some gun owners that's reflecting this kind of attitude. And when you have lots of people with paranoid thinking in their brains and concealed weapons in their pockets, I kind of worry. You know, these are very dangerous weapons, and certainly the more information the government has about who has them and where they have them is appropriate. If people believe they should have a gun to protect themselves, so be it. But we should know where they are and where those guns are.
What's the model for regulation that is actually effective in preemptively deterring violence as opposed to being something that we look at after the fact and regulate after an incident?
Well, what there hasn't been a lot of talk these days recently is about the Tehart Amendment. That was an amendment passed several years ago in Congress that prevents the gun tracing data to be distributed and released to those who can figure out what kind of – what dealers out there, what rogue dealers are responsible for most of the guns getting into the illegal gun market. We know, for example, from previous analyses that less than 1% of gun dealers are responsible for over half the guns used in crime in this country. We need to allow that information to be released publicly so we can crack down on the gun dealers that are just not doing a very good job about background checks, about preventing straw purchases, and not keeping good records.
Some effective models for possible new gun regulations as we anticipate what Vice President Joe Biden and the Obama administration will be proposing this week. James Fox, professor of criminology, law, and public policy at Northeastern University. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.